You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
On October 26, 1965, a 16-year-old girl named Sylvia Likens died in Indianapolis from shock, malnutrition, and a brain hemorrhage. She'd been tortured for 3 months, and by the time she died, she could barely move or speak. She'd been tortured, neglected, sexually humiliated, starved, beaten, and cut by her tormentors. Her autopsy later revealed 150 wounds on her body, including cigarette burns, skin brandings, and knife wounds. What had Sylvia done to deserve such torture? Nothing. And who had tortured her so brutally that it killed her? Was it a faceless abductor, a stranger who took her for some depraved purpose? No, her killer was a family friend and a group of children who lived in her neighborhood, attended her school, and were actually once considered her friends. Police officers considered her murder one of the worst crimes in Indiana history. As one senior investigator later said, "I'd never seen anything like it. It was the most sadistic case I ever investigated in the 35 years that I served with the Indianapolis Police Department." The district attorney who prosecuted the crime described it as the most diabolical case to ever come before a court or jury. This is, without a doubt, one of the worst stories we've ever featured on the podcast. I don't often give you a warning about the story you're about to hear. I usually feel like you know what you're getting yourself into when you see its description ahead, but this time it's different. I'm not sure this episode will be for everyone. So if you choose to listen, just remember, you've been warned. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season offers the true story behind the horrifying films, stories that are usually much scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 17 of season 9. an American crime. Sylvia Marie Likens was born on January 3, 1949, the third of five children of Lester Likens and his wife Elizabeth, who went by Betty. She was born between two sets of fraternal twins, Daniel and Diana, who were a few years older, and Benny and Jenny, who were a year younger. Jenny suffered from polio when she was a child, leaving one of her legs weaker than the other. She walked with a noticeable limp and wore a steel brace on her leg. Sylvia grew up always protective of her more timid and insecure little sister. Many would remember seeing the two girls at a local skating rink where Sylvia would help Jenny skate by holding her hand and helping her keep her balance as she skated on her unaffected foot. Sylvia's parents were carnival workers, and their marriage had always been unstable. They operated what were called grab joints during fair season, selling candy, beer, soda, and snacks that customers could grab while enjoying the games and attractions on the Midway. They moved often and frequently dealt with serious financial problems. The older children, along with Benny, often traveled with their parents to help out at the carnival, but Sylvia and Jenny were never allowed to do so. Lester, understandably, felt the carnivals weren't safe and wanted the girls to stay in school. He struggled to make ends meet with an eighth-grade education, and he didn't want that for his daughters. Because of this, the sisters frequently stayed with relatives, usually their grandmother. Sylvia managed to cope well with her circumstances, hoping to rise above the poverty and neglect that had been a normal part of her life. She did well in school and earned spending money by babysitting, running errands, and doing chores for friends and neighbors, often giving her parents part of her earnings. She was described as friendly, confident, and outgoing, and was known as Cookie by her friends. She had long, wavy, light brown hair, and although she loved to laugh, she always tried to keep her mouth closed when she smiled because of a missing front tooth. She'd lost it roughhousing with her brothers during a childhood game. Sylvia also loved music, especially the Beatles. And while she could rarely afford records, she had a small radio that was her prized possession. The previous year, the Likens family had moved from Long Beach, California to Indianapolis, where Sylvia and Jenny were enrolled at the Arsenal Technical High School. After the school year ended in June 1956, Lester made plans to go back on the road. He managed to get hooked up with a Midway show and was going to be touring the East Coast for the season. It was going to mean decent money for a change, and he was set to leave right after the 4th of July holiday. Betty was going to be staying home with the girls, but then on July 3rd, Betty was arrested for shoplifting and locked up. This put Lester in a bad position. Betty had been staying home because there was no one for Sylvia and Jenny to live with while he was gone. He couldn't pass up the chance for work, so he needed to find some place for them to stay. And then if he could, Betty could join him on the carnival circuit when she got out of jail. As it happened, Sylvia and Jenny were friends with two girls from school named Paula and Stephanie Banachevsky. They'd met their mother, Gertrude, a few times and knew she was as poor as the Likens family. She had seven children of her own, and most of the money she made came from doing ironing for neighbors. Although he wasn't sure if Gertrude was up for caring for two more teenage girls, Lester was out of options, and so he arranged for Sylvia and Jenny to board with her for $20 a week. Lester promised to send the money every week until he and Betty returned home at the end of the season. Gertrude was pleased with the arrangement. The $20 was the equivalent of about $205 today, but considering that the rent at her home on East New York Street in Indianapolis was only $55 a month, it would put her in a much better financial situation. When Lester dropped them off with their suitcases, Gertrude promised she would care for his daughters until his return, as if they were her own children. Lester likely felt his children were in good hands when he left Indianapolis to join the carnival in Pennsylvania, but he had no idea that he'd just turned them over to a monster. Gertrude Banachevsky was born in Indianapolis. Her parents were working-class immigrants, originally from Illinois, and Gertrude was the third of six children. Her family was relatively stable while she was growing up, but then her father died from a sudden heart attack when he was only 50. This plunged the family into poverty. Gertrude dropped out of school at 16 and married 18-year-old John Banachevsky, a Pennsylvania man with whom she had four children. Although John had a volatile temper and frequently beat his wife, the two remained together for 10 years before they divorced. Gertrude next married a man named Edward Guthrie, but this marriage only lasted 3 months before they split up. Right away, she remarried her first husband, and they had two more children before divorcing a second time in 1963. Weeks after her third divorce, Gertrude started seeing a 20-year-old welder named Dennis Wright, who also abused her. Not long after their relationship started, she became pregnant and gave birth to a son in May 1964. The pair split up soon after, and Gertrude was forced to file a paternity suit against Dennis to get him to pay child support for their baby. He often came around to see the boy and to ask Gertrude for money, but he rarely offered her any cash in return. By 1965, Gertrude lived alone in her dilapidated home with her seven children: Paula, who was 17, Stephanie, 15, John, 12, Marie, who was 11, Shirley was 10, James was 8, and baby Denny, who was 1. She was now 36 years old and a small woman who weighed only 100 pounds. She was described as a haggard, underweight, asthmatic chain smoker, and she suffered from clinical depression thanks to the stress of three failed marriages, a failed relationship, and a recent miscarriage. Aside from the money she made by doing ironing, she occasionally receives checks from her first husband, John, who'd been an Indianapolis police officer. It was a cruel, unhappy life of poverty that had turned Gertrude into a bitter, angry woman who likely shouldn't have had custody of her own children, let alone two extra teenage girls. But it was a time and a place where few people noticed, and even fewer people cared. For the first few weeks, Sylvia and Jenny were treated well. Sylvia loved singing along to pop records with Stephanie, and she helped with chores around the house. Both girls attended Sunday school each week with the Banachevsky kids, and it seemed as though the weeks until they could be back with their parents would pass quickly. But of course, they didn't know it was only going to take one small thing for Gertrude to crack: money. When Lester had left the girls with her, he had agreed to pay Gertrude $20 a week in exchange for her caring for his daughters. But after a few weeks, the payments failed to arrive on the dates that had been promised. They always showed up, but usually one or two days late. Well, this turned the atmosphere in the house hostile. Gertrude began venting her frustration about the late payments on the two sisters, beating their bare buttocks with various things, including a wooden paddle. "I took care of you two bitches for 2 weeks for nothing," Gertrude screamed at them one day. The money from Lester arrived the following day, but it didn't seem to matter. And this was just the start of the horror that followed. One day in early August, both girls were struck at least 15 times on the back with that wooden paddle after Paula told her mother that the sisters had eaten too much food at a church supper that all the children had attended. But within a week or so of this incident, Gertrude began to focus her abuse on Sylvia alone. No one knows why. Some have suggested she was jealous of Sylvia's youth, her pretty face, or her potential. I think it's just as likely that Gertrude was evil. The abuse began with the beatings, using the paddle or a thick leather belt that had belonged to her first husband, the cop. Gertrude invented crimes so that Sylvia could be tortured. She accused her of stealing and burned her fingertips. She starved her, forcing her to eat leftovers and spoiled food out of the garbage can. Often, Gertrude forced Jenny to join in on the beatings, threatening that she would be taking her sister's place if she refused. Earlier in their stay, before things had turned contentious in the house, Sylvia had told Paula that she'd had a boyfriend when the family lived in California. One day in late August, Gertrude brought this up and asked Sylvia if she'd ever done anything with a boy. Sylvia, unsure of what she meant, replied that she guessed she had. She explained she'd gone skating with boys and had gone to the park or to the beach with them. Continuing the conversation, she told Jenny and Stephanie she'd once been under the covers with her boyfriend. "Why did you do that, Sylvia?" Gertrude interrupted. Sylvia shrugged. "I don't know," she said. A few days later, Gertrude brought this up again and told Sylvia, "You're certainly getting big in the stomach. It looks like you're going to have a baby." Sylvia thought that Gertrude was joking with her, which was something she'd done when the girls had first come to stay with her. So she laughed as she replied, "Yeah, it sure is getting big. I'm just going to have to go on a diet." Well, the laughter set Gertrude off. She told her and the other girls that whenever they did something with a boy, they were sure to have a baby. She then kicked Sylvia between her legs. Paula, who was 3 months pregnant at the time, unknown to her mother, joined in the abuse, knocking Sylvia off her chair and onto the kitchen floor. She kicked her several times and told her she wasn't fit to sit in a chair. Another night, as the family was eating supper, Gertrude, Paula, and a neighborhood boy named Randy Lepper force-fed Sylvia hot dogs slathered with mustard and spices until she vomited. Then, as punishment for being wasteful by throwing up good food, she forced her to eat her own vomit. Further abuse was unknowingly caused by Sylvia herself. She accidentally spilled the information that Paula was pregnant, which was something considered scandalous for an unmarried woman in the mid-1960s. While at school, Stephanie was jokingly propositioned by a boy who assumed she'd be as easy as her sister was. When Stephanie confronted Sylvia about this, she burst into tears and admitted she'd failed to keep the secret. Stephanie punched her in response, but Sylvia apologized to her, and Stephanie then also began to cry. However, when Stephanie's boyfriend, Coy Hubbard, heard what happened at school, he brutally attacked Sylvia, slapping her, banging her head against the wall, and knocking her to the floor. When Gertrude found out, she used the paddle to beat Sylvia. On another occasion, Paula hit Sylvia in the face and the mouth with such force that she broke her own wrist. Later, she used the cast on her arm to beat her with. She and Gertrude frequently accused Sylvia of being promiscuous or claimed she was a prostitute. Gertrude then started to allow, she encouraged her other children to take part in the abuse. Often, Coy Hubbard and other classmates visited the house so they could take part in the verbal and physical torment too. The children routinely beat Sylvia, sometimes using her as a judo practice dummy, they called it. She was thrown against walls, punched, kicked, and pushed down the stairs. They cut her skin, burned her with cigarettes, and rubbed salt into the wounds. After being brutalized, she was often cleansed in scalding hot bath water. Once, to entertain Gertrude and her teenage accomplices, Sylvia was forced to strip naked in the living room and to penetrate herself with a glass Pepsi bottle while everyone watched. Gertrude said this act of humiliation was so that Jenny could, quote, see what kind of girl you are. Gertrude preached deluded sermons about the evil of premarital sex while savagely kicking Sylvia between the legs. Around this same time, she stopped allowing Sylvia to attend school. Sylvia had confessed to stealing a gym suit from the school because Gertrude wouldn't purchase any clothing for her to wear. As punishment for the theft, she whipped Sylvia with the police belt. Sylvia was now living in a real-life horror film, but things were soon going to become even worse. It's impossible to hear about the horrific things happening to Sylvia without asking, why didn't she or Jenny tell anyone what was happening? Well, the answer to that is both simple and complicated. Both were terrified that if they told their family or adults at school about the situation, it would only make things worse. Jenny in particular struggled to stay silent, but she'd been threatened by Gertrude repeatedly that if she talked, she would be tortured and abused the same way her sister was. You might think that by alerting some responsible person, this might stop all the torture, but it hadn't been hard to convince Jenny this wasn't true. She was told no one would believe it, and she was likely convinced of that. She'd already tried to tell some girls in the neighborhood about what was going on, and they'd accused her of lying. Worse, in both July and August, Lester and Betty had returned to Indianapolis to visit their daughters a few times, but each time they were in the presence of Gertrude and her children. Knowing their parents were going to leave again, they were too scared to say anything. Again, knowing it would make things worse. In early September, the girls had encountered their older married sister, Diana, at a local park. Unfortunately, Gertrude's daughter, Marie, was with them, and they had no chance to tell Diana about the abuse. The only thing that Sylvia said was that she was hungry, so Diana gave her a sandwich to eat. Marie later told her mother about this, and Gertrude accused Sylvia of gluttony before she and Paula choked and beat her. The pair then forced her into another scalding bath so that she could be cleansed of her sin. When Sylvia fainted from the heat, Gertrude banged her head against the side of the tub until she woke up. 2 weeks later, Sylvia and Jenny, alone this time, saw Diana again. This time, they told her about the abuse, but Diana had no idea where the Banachevsky family lived, and neither girl told her the address. At this point, Diana just assumed the girls were exaggerating how bad things were. Tragically, though, she'd soon find out this wasn't the case. Around this same time, the father of a neighborhood boy named Michael Moore called Arsenal Technical High School to anonymously report that a girl with open sores all over her body was living at the Banachevsky home. Since Sylvia had not been at school for some time, a school nurse went to the home to investigate the claims. But Gertrude told the nurse that Sylvia had run away from home the previous week, and she had no idea where she was. She claimed that Sylvia was out of control and that her open sores were caused by Sylvia's refusal to maintain good personal hygiene. Sylvia was, she told the nurse, a bad influence on both her own children and her sister. Unbelievably, the school made no further effort to check on Sylvia's welfare. Gertrude's next-door neighbors were a middle-aged couple named Raymond and Phyllis Vermillion. Both had initially believed that Gertrude was an excellent caregiver for the Likens sisters and had visited the home on two occasions while Sylvia and Jenny were in her care. But their feelings eventually changed, thanks to screams heard coming from the home and witnessing Paula physically abusing Sylvia. Paula even openly boasted about her mistreatment of Sylvia to them. And so what did they do about this obvious abuse? Nothing. They decided to mind their own business and not cause trouble. Then on or about October 1st, Diana, who hadn't stopped thinking about what her sisters had told her, finally tracked down an address for the Banachevsky house. She visited the home and asked to see Sylvia and Jenny, but Gertrude refused to let her in, saying that she hadn't been given permission from Lester and Betty for her to visit the girls, and she ordered Diana off the property. Well, this led to another beating for Sylvia, who was punished by Gertrude for telling her sister where she lived. Sylvia and Jenny had done everything they dared to do, but the adults who knew about the situation, from the anonymous call to the gullible nurse and the neighbors who heard the screams, did nothing to save them. In the days after Diana's attempted visit, the abuse and torture increased. Gertrude often told her children that Sylvia had said bad things about them, hoping this would provoke them into attacking her. The only relief that Sylvia ever enjoyed was when the torment stopped so the Banachevskis could watch their favorite television shows. Thanks to the brutality and torture that Sylvia was subjected to, she gradually became incontinent. She was denied any access to a bathroom, so she was forced to wet herself. Then, as punishment for that, she was locked up in the basement. She was tied up, usually kept naked, rarely fed, and mostly deprived of water. She was often tied to the railing of the basement stairs, with only her toes touching the ground. Well, in the basement, the abuse continued. Sylvia was tortured by Gertrude, her children, and by the neighborhood kids, too. Later during the trial, some of those children claimed Gertrude recruited them, telling them that Sylvia was a whore and she deserved it. One girl admitted that she never bothered to find out if anything Gertrude told her was true. She was invited over to knock Sylvia to the ground, beat her face, and kick her. Almost all those children claimed they were brainwashed into abusing Sylvia by Gertrude, but one part they left out of their stories was that they had all paid 5 cents to see Sylvia naked and to humiliate, beat, burn, and mutilate her. During her captivity in the basement, all of them had helped to restrain and gag her and rubbed salt in her open wounds. On one occasion, Gertrude and her son John forced Sylvia to eat urine-soaked feces out of baby Denny's diapers before giving her a cup that was half filled with water and telling her that was all she'd get for the rest of the day. On October 22nd, John tormented her by allowing her to eat a bowl of soup with her fingers, but then took it away from her when she tried. By this time, Sylvia was suffering from severe malnutrition. Gertrude eventually allowed Sylvia to sleep upstairs again, but only on the condition she didn't wet the bed. Unfortunately, her condition prevented her from keeping that promise. When Gertrude discovered the next morning she'd urinated on herself, Sylvia was forced to insert an empty glass Coca-Cola bottle into her vagina in front of the other children. She was also ordered back to the basement, where Gertrude told her that since Sylvia had branded her children, whatever that was supposed to mean, she was going to brand Sylvia. Using a hot needle, she started carving the words, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," into the girl's abdomen. When Gertrude was unable to finish the branding, one of the neighborhood children, 14-year-old Richard Hobbs, took over, scorching the letters into her flesh while she clenched her teeth and moaned. Richard and Gertrude's daughter, 10-year-old Shirley, then tried to use a metal bolt to burn the letter S onto Sylvia's skin under her left breast. They were so stupid that they did part of it backwards, so it ended up looking like a number 3. Gertrude later taunted Sylvia by claiming she'd never be able to get married with those words branded into her stomach, telling her, "Sylvia, what are you going to do now? You can't get married now. What are you going to do?" Weeping, Sylvia replied, "I guess there's nothing I can do." Later that day, Sylvia was forced to show the carving to the neighborhood children while Gertrude claimed she'd received the branding at a sex party. Well, that night, Sylvia told her sister, "Jenny, I know you don't want me to die, but I'm going to die. I can tell it." On October 24th, Gertrude woke Sylvia and forced her to write a letter to her parents, claiming she'd run away with a group of boys that she promised to have sex with, but the boys had then beaten and mutilated her. After she finished the letter, Sylvia was tied again to the stair railing and offered crackers to eat, but she refused them. She told Gertrude to give them to the dog. She didn't want them. In response, the woman forced the crackers into Sylvia's mouth, and she and John beat her until she lost consciousness. The following day, October 25th, Sylvia overheard Gertrude making plans with John to blindfold Sylvia and then take her to a nearby wooded area known as Jimmy's Forest and leave her there to die. When she was eventually found, Gertrude believed the blame would be placed for her abuse and torture on those imaginary boys. Well, desperate, Sylvia tried to escape. She managed to make it just outside the front door before Gertrude caught her. Even if she had made it, she was so weak from her injuries, starved and dehydrated, she wouldn't have gotten far. With help from Coy Hubbard, Gertrude beat Sylvia with a curtain rod until she was unconscious. The pair then dragged her back down into the basement. That evening, Sylvia made another desperate attempt to escape. She tried to alert the neighbors by screaming for help and banging on the basement walls with a spade. A neighbor on the opposite side of the house from the Vermillions later told the police she'd heard the commotion, and she knew it was coming from the Banachevsky basement. But since it suddenly stopped around 3 a.m., she decided not to call the police. It makes me wonder how long it had been going on before it stopped. What kind of person hears a young woman screaming for help and does nothing? Apparently, people who lived on this block in Indianapolis in 1965, I guess. By the morning of October 26th, Sylvia was unable to speak coherently. She couldn't form sentences, and she couldn't make her limbs move the way she needed them to move. Gertrude took her into the kitchen, propped her up against the wall, and tried to feed her a donut and a glass of milk. She shoved Sylvia to the floor in frustration when the young woman was unable to drink the milk without it running out of her mouth. Sylvia was then dragged back down to the basement. As the morning went on, Sylvia became delirious, moaning and mumbling. When Paula demanded that she recite the alphabet, Sylvia couldn't get beyond the first four letters. Paula then began ordering her to stand up, telling her that if she didn't, she would jump on her. Well, Sylvia wobbly made it to her feet, but fell down again. That afternoon, several of her tormentors gathered in the basement. Sylvia tried to raise her arm to point at the faces of her abusers, the ones she recognized anyway. And when she pointed at Gertrude and croaked out her name, the woman became enraged, shouting at her to stop talking, that she knew who she was. The monsters stared at her silently and climbed the basement stairs, leaving Sylvia in the darkness. Even Jenny had left her. She went to a neighbor's home to do some gardening and earn some money. That afternoon, Sylvia was given a bath by John Banachevsky. And by bath, I mean that he sprayed her down with a hose. Sylvia again tried to escape, but collapsed before she could reach the stairs. In punishment, Gertrude stomped on her head. Shortly after 5:30 p.m., neighbor Richard Hobbs returned to the house and went down to the basement. He slipped on the wet basement stairs, though, and was startled when he found that he and Sylvia were not in the basement alone. Stephanie was there. She was crying and cradling Sylvia's emaciated body after she'd been ordered to clean the girl up. Richard and Stephanie then managed to get Sylvia upstairs, where they gave her a warm, soapy bath and dressed her in clean clothing. She was placed on a mattress in one of the bedrooms. That was when Sylvia uttered her final words, a wish that her daddy was there to get her, and she asked Stephanie to take her home. Stephanie then turned to her younger sister, Shirley, and exclaimed, "Oh, she'll be all right." And then she realized that Sylvia wasn't breathing. In a panic, Stephanie shook her, trying to get her to wake up. But it was too late. Sylvia Likens was dead. When Stephanie cried out that Sylvia had died, Gertrude went into a rage, screaming that Sylvia was faking it. She wasn't dead. She beat on the young woman's body with a book, crying out that she was a faker as she tried to rouse her. But when Sylvia didn't respond, she panicked and sent Richard Hobbs to call the police from a nearby payphone. When the police arrived, Gertrude stuck by her cover story, that Sylvia had been beaten to death by boys that she was with. They'd even carved, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," into her body. She also claimed that she'd been doctoring the girl for more than an hour before she died. As Gertrude tried to spin her story to the police, Paula stood in the living room, clutching a Bible and telling everyone that Sylvia's death was, quote, meant to happen. And then she looked over at Jenny and said to her calmly, "If you want to live with us, Jenny, we'll treat you like our own sister." When the police talked to Jenny about her sister's death, she initially recited Gertrude's story as she'd been instructed. But then she realized this was finally her chance to escape. She managed to get close to one of the police officers and whispered to him, "Get me out of here, and I'll tell you everything." Thanks to a statement provided by Jenny, Gertrude was arrested for murder within hours of Sylvia's death. The police also arrested Paula, Stephanie, John, as well as Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard. The children were all placed in juvenile detention, held without bail pending trial. At first, Gertrude denied any involvement in Sylvia's death, although within a day, she was blaming the kids, mostly Paula and Coy Hubbard, for physically and emotionally abusing Sylvia. She further admitted to forcing Sylvia to sleep in the basement a few times when she wet the bed, but then became evasive when one detective stated the likely reason for that was because she'd been mentally tortured and her kidneys were damaged. Paula had no remorse at all. She quickly signed a statement that admitted she'd repeatedly beaten Sylvia with the police belt, had broken her wrist punching Sylvia in the jaw, and inflicted other brutal acts on her, like pushing her down the basement stairs and giving her a black eye. John admitted he'd spanked Sylvia, but said it was only one time, but then told police that he preferred to punish her with his fists. He confessed to burning Sylvia with matches a few times, but accused his mother of repeatedly burning her with cigarettes. Five other neighborhood children, Mike Monroe, Randy Lepper, Darlene McGuire, Judy Duke, and Anna Sisko, were also arrested for injury to person. All of them were minors, and all of them blamed Gertrude for pressuring them into taking part in the torture. They were each released into the custody of their parents, but were ordered to be witnesses at the upcoming trial. Even worse were the arrests of the children the police let go. They'd also been involved, but were too young to be charged. Gertrude, Paula, John, Richard Hobbs, and Coy Hubbard were all tried together. Jury selection began on April 18, 1966. Jenny testified, as did the coroner, who detailed Sylvia's autopsy report and the more than 150 wounds on her body. The official cause of death had been a subdural hematoma caused by a severe blow to her right temple. The other contributing factors that killed her were shock, caused by severe and prolonged damage to her body, and severe malnutrition. The wounds on her body included burns, severe bruising, and muscle and nerve damage. Her vaginal cavity was swollen shut. Most of her fingernails had been broken backward, and most of the external layers of skin on her face, breasts, neck, and right knee had peeled or receded. As she was dying, Sylvia had bitten through her lips, partially severing them from her face. Jenny's testimony painted a horrific picture of life in the Banachevsky house, as did testimony from neighborhood children who'd participated in the abuse. Gertrude testified in her own defense and denied any responsibility for Sylvia's prolonged torture and her ultimate death, claiming her children and their friends must have committed the acts in her home without her knowledge. She added she'd been too preoccupied with her own poor health and depression to control her children. Richard Hobbs offered his own self-serving testimony, but his claims of not participating in the torture were destroyed when Marie Banachevsky took the stand and wept as she described how Richard had branded Sylvia with the hot needle. She also testified about her mother's full knowledge of Sylvia's abuse and her part in it. She testified that even though all five defendants had repeatedly tortured Sylvia, she had most often witnessed abuse by her mother and her sister before Gertrude had forced Sylvia to live in the basement, where things had further escalated and Sylvia had died. During closing arguments, one of the prosecutors stated that what had been done to Sylvia was the equivalent to what was done to prisoners in Nazi concentration camps. The trial lasted for 17 days, but the jury only took 8 hours to deliberate. Paula, who had given birth to a daughter during the trial, was convicted of second-degree murder and ordered to spend life behind bars. In 1971, she was retried and this time pled guilty to a lesser crime of voluntary manslaughter. Despite twice unsuccessfully attempting to escape from prison, she was released in 1972 after spending only 8 years behind bars. Hiding from her past, she moved to Iowa, changed her name, and worked as an aide to a school counselor for the next 14 years. She was fired in 2012, though, when an anonymous caller tipped off the school district about her past. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banachewski were all convicted of manslaughter and given shorter sentences as minors. All served less than 2 years at the Indiana State Reformatory and were released in 1968. Richard Hobbs died of lung cancer in 1972 at the age of just 21. In the years between his release from the reformatory and his death, he is known to have suffered at least one nervous breakdown. I'd like to think that Sylvia got her revenge from beyond the grave, but that's probably just wishful thinking. Coy Hubbard remained in Indiana after his release and never attempted to change his name. Throughout his adult life, he was repeatedly in and out of jail for various offenses and was suspected of the murders of two young men in 1977, but his involvement couldn't be proved. In 2007, when the film An American Crime came out, Hubbard was fired from his job. He had a heart attack later that year and died at the age of 56. John Banachewski changed his name to John Blake and lived in relative obscurity for most of his life. He became a lay minister, frequently providing counseling sessions for children with divorced parents. He later admitted to his crimes and stated that he should have received a longer sentence, although he didn't believe young criminals were beyond rehabilitation, using his own changed life as an example. John truly seemed to have become a better man, until on his deathbed when he admitted that he'd enjoyed the attention that Sylvia's murder brought to him. He died from diabetes in 2005 at the age of 52. At trial, Gertrude had been convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Prosecutors had sought the death penalty, but she was spared, despite her own lawyer admitting that, quote, in my opinion, she ought to go to the electric chair. She was retried with Paula in 1971, but her sentence was upheld. Over the course of the next 14 years, she became known as a model prisoner at the Indiana Women's Prison, working in the sewing shop and becoming sort of a den mother to younger inmates who called her mom. Gross. Then on December 5th, 1985, she was granted parole for good behavior. Despite protests from Jenny and other family members and various anti-crime groups who gathered more than 40,000 signatures demanding she remain in prison, Gertrude was released. She also moved to Iowa and, not surprisingly, never accepted responsibility for Sylvia's torture and death, blaming the children and the medication she'd been prescribed to treat her asthma. She never once expressed any remorse for her part in Sylvia's death. And she remained a monster until the end. She continued living in Laurel, Iowa until her death from lung cancer in June 1990 at the age of 61. Jenny Likens later married an Indianapolis man named Leonard Wade. They had two children and likely would have had a happy life if Jenny had not remained so traumatized by the abuse she'd been forced to watch her sister endure at the Banachewski home. She remained on anxiety medication throughout her life. She often spoke about that terrible time, but never blamed her parents for what happened. Betty and Leonard died in 1998 and in 2013. She said the only thing they had done wrong was to naively trust the care of their daughters to a woman who turned out to be a terrible person. Sadly, Jenny died of a heart attack in June 2004. She was only 54 years old. However, 14 years earlier, Jenny had gotten some good news when she saw in the newspaper that Gertrude had died from lung cancer. She sent her mother a copy of the obituary with a short note that read, "Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha. I am so happy about that." And who can blame her? Gertrude's death meant that there was just a little less evil in the world. There have been two films made that were inspired by the murder of Sylvia Likens, although we only covered one of them in this episode. The second, The Girl Next Door, is a film based on a novel that was loosely inspired by the crime. Names and circumstances were changed, and it's much more exploitative than In American Crime, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2007. Unfortunately, it never received a theatrical release, although it should have. But because of internal problems with the film's original distributor, it officially premiered on Showtime in May 2008. The film has an amazing cast, although it is a gut-wrenching watch. As you know, if you've seen it, it follows so closely to the true story that there's really no need to include a synopsis here. The film was written and directed by Tommy O'Haver and stars Catherine Keener, Elliot Page, when they were still Ellen Page, Evan Peters, James Franco, Brian Garrity, Scott Taylor Compton, Michael O'Keefe, and Bradley Whitford, among other many recognizable faces. It was filmed in 2006, and most of the cast was completely unaware of the real murder until after they read the script, which was based on the actual court transcripts of the case. At first, Catherine Keener had turned down the part of Gertrude, but later said that she was unable to get the story out of her head, so she had another meeting with the director before agreeing to do the film. I'm sure that, as an actor, it was a challenge to get into the head of Gertrude Banachevsky for a little while. But I don't think that's anywhere that anyone would want to stay for long. Pretending to be a monster is much different than simply being one. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Why don't you leave Sylvia and Jenny here with me? I got 6 kids. 2 more won't make a difference. $20 a week and you won't have to worry. I want you all upstairs. Except for you two. Your daddy's check didn't arrive today.
Oh, it's probably just late.
Lean over those. She needs to be punished.
How long until Sylvia's out of the basement?
Until she learns her lesson.
Did anyone order you to hit Sylvia or tie her up?
What are you, chicken?
If Mama said you can.
Did you do anything at all to help her?
Wouldn't come between Gertie and her kids. You don't like her much.
I don't understand.
Why did you do it?
There are things in life we have to do, whether we like it or not.
Thank you.
least we get to be a little creative here.
Yes.
And yeah, I'm ready.
I'm ready when you are.
All right. Hey, ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? We're back with the postmortem part of the show. That's the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who mutually decided with me that this is a very tough episode about which to make jokes. It's my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
I'm almost speechless this time.
I know. I get it. I totally get it. It's an awful, awful episode. I'm hoping there are still people listening.
Yeah.
At this point, you know, yeah. I don't think I'd ever warned anybody about content this entire, you know, I mean, I'm used to doing it with the Patreon show sometimes, but I have not done it with one of our regular shows I don't think.
Oh, not this season.
No, but we have in the past.
Marion yeah. Parker and things.
Yeah,
and...
yeah, yeah. We have in the past. I have not done it this season, mostly just because, well, it's just movies. You know, we're talking about movies a lot. And yeah, this was a movie, but, you know, was also just like the most horrific story you can imagine. It's just one of those stories where, I mean, you know, you see, I research, unfortunately, a lot of depravity in my job, but there was just something so sick about this story that it's just happened in a regular neighborhood with ordinary people that, you know, and a bunch of kids. It just got sucked into this evil, you know, plain evil. I don't know what else to call it.
And so. I have a lot to talk about, a lot to ask about. But before we get into that, let's do everything else. And then
tickets are on sale now for our tours in Decatur, Springfield, Alton, where we have walking tours, bus tours, pub crawls, dinner tours, dinner events, the American Oddities Museum, the Halloween Seance on Halloween, and a whole lot of other stuff. So you can find your way to everything we offer at AmericanHauntings.net, or you can go to dinnerandspirits.com for any of the things that I will be doing personally. This late addition to the script, which I stuck in here like 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. We wanted to remind everybody, because we did not mention it at all in our last episode, that American Dread, a new podcast that's connected to American Hauntings, will be airing episode number 2, I believe, on Wednesday. Am I correct?
Yep.
Yes. This Wednesday, another episode of American Dread. So if you liked the first one, let us know. If you didn't like the first one, let us know that too. But so far, the feedback has all been pretty good as far as I can tell. Now, I only hear what people say. I don't. You're the one who sees, you know, technical things. I don't see how the sausage is made. I just hear about it later.
So. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, hey, send us an email, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or there we have a poll on each episode on Spotify too.
Oh, cool.
Let us know. And just, awesome. Just let us know what you think about the show.
Yeah. Let us know what you think. We'll be curious to hear. So also, I just wanted to mention one more thing, which I'm holding it up and I'm showing it to Cody right now. And there's no way that he can know exactly what this is.
I thought it was a typo.
No, I have not announced it yet. But it is literally a piece of Lizzie Borden's silverware for real.
Wow.
Authenticated and everything. It came from the estate of a distant cousin of hers who also lived in Fall River. That's Lizzie Borden, the notorious accused hatchet murderer from 1892. But yeah, a real fork. Just think of this. I'm literally holding in my hand right now a fork that Lizzie Borden ate her dinner with.
That's amazing.
I know. So anyway, it's going to go on display at the American Oddities Museum starting this Friday. So if you'd like to see a little bit of real live crime history, come see it.
And we have to ask.
Really excited about this.
I'm sure you're not
obviously.
Going. I know you're not going to, but are you going to eat anything with it?
I'd rather not say.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. That makes it easy then.
I'd rather not say, but I might have already. Anyway,
We'll talk about it off air. I'll move on to our new Patreon subscriber. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Ashley, Carrie, Kelly, Nicole, Brandy, Bridget, Karen, Beth, Bobby, Nick, and Summer. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Did we just wrap up?
I did. Yeah, we just had the season finale of Monster. That was the Albert Fish season. I had a lot of comments on from people. Honestly, I'm glad to be done with the season, frankly.
Yeah.
I really am. And a lot of our listeners, while, you know, expressed enjoying it, I mean, no one stopped listening to it as far as I know, but they all were kind of glad that it was going to be over too. Many of them mentioned they would never look at peanut butter the same way again, along with many other things. So now we have five seasons that you can binge if you join up with our Patreon group, available on patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. That's a show we offer every other week, so it sort of fits into the regular run of this show. So you get a new episode every week with no waiting. Patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And I should probably add that this Friday, we will be offering the teaser trailer for season 6 of the Dead Men Do Tell Tales podcast. So that is our Patreon show that we offer. And we're going to be jumping right into the next season, which a few people, only a handful of people even know what it's going to be about, and they're very excited. So hopefully all of you will be too. So keep an eye out on this feed. You can hear that teaser. It'll also be on our Patreon feed, and I'll probably post it an easy way for you to hear it or get to it on my Facebook page so that you can see what it's going to be about. And I, for one, am pretty excited about this one. There is no story that makes me as angry as this one does.
Is it going to be gross?
Not like the Albert Fish one, but it's going to be controversial because every time it's brought up, it's controversial. And I said, there isn't much that makes me angrier than this story does.
Okay. So, I have some guesses, but I won't toss them out here. I do want to dive into a listener review.
Sure.
On Apple, from Apple Podcast. And this one's from Ms. Bear Rashida. Now, Troy, this is an interesting review that we have. I'm going to read it in its entirety.
Okay.
I don't know how I feel about it.
Okay.
I'm going to read it.
Is it bad? Is it making you uncomfortable?
Yeah.
Do you have strange feelings about it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm ready.
All right. So it's titled Pure Ecstasy.
Okay.
And the review is, dang it, Troy, you had me hooked the first time I heard your critique of the Warrens. I love the movies, but the people, yes, then those dang books of yours. Jesus, you got my daughter back into reading, and she's stolen several of your books from me. Cody, I love your banter with Troy, and you gentlemen do an awesome job. You brought my big three, paranormal, crime, and history, into the sexiest mental threesome this tiny, tiny brain can handle. Often things leaving me with the feeling I need to smoke a cigarette after an episode. Yes, that mental O is just that dang good.
Okay.
So.
Well, all right then. So, yeah. Well, I guess I'll say what I say to everybody else. If you heard your review being read, text us your address on the haunt line at 217-791-7859, and we'll make sure that you get some cool free stuff in the mail. Yes, we are bribing you to post reviews, and if we read them, you will receive your bribe. We'll come back to the haunt line later on. And we also have to discuss something very quickly when we come back about, that we were asked last time about stories that we'd like to see turned into films. So
yes.
I have my list here. Just a short one, just a handful of things. None of them will be surprising, but we'll come back to that after because we're going to need something a little bit more lighthearted to talk about once we're finished discussing this episode.
Yes.
All right. So with that, I guess we should begin. What would you like to talk about?
Sure. So, definitely not going to relive this whole thing.
Good. That's good. Because I don't really want to do that.
So. Yeah. But no. I definitely do have questions. And
okay.
And I'm wondering, you know, were their own children abused? Was it the fact that this was an outsider, a different? Do you know what I mean?
No. Yes, I do. And no, there were never any charges that she abused her own kids. The Banachevsky kids were never. They were the ones doing the abusing.
Right.
And I think that, you know, I think I kind of mentioned this in the episode that they seemed like they were just brainwashed into this. Mm. You know, I mean, this is a woman who, you know, Gertrude's this woman who'd had a pretty rough upbringing. She'd been involved in several abusive relationships. Some of the things that happened might have been things that she brought on herself. I mean, her chain smoking, her poor health, or, you know, the medications she was taking. Bad choices, a lot of bad choices here. I'm not blaming her for, you know, ended up with abusive guys, but I do have to blame her for the way that she treated these girls, especially Sylvia, of course. You know, not that Jenny got away with nothing, because her life was essentially ruined by this whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, being there watching and having to experience the, you know, abuse that her sister went through, and even being forced to take part in it at times, because here's a, you know, kind of a somewhat quiet, kind of backward, insecure young girl who, you know, had suffered from polio. And so, you know, she wears a leg brace, and, you know, none of that could be easy. You know, her sister had always looked out for her, had always protected her. Now, you know, she can't protect her anymore. And so she's, you know, at the mercy of this crazed woman and her horrible children, you know, who were, you know, taking part in all of this abuse. You can kind of see where it kind of really messed her up, too.
Of course. Yeah. And do you, so with a lot of times, I think with children and things, I kind of teeter back and forth. But so the adults absolutely can't forgive. They had an opportunity. They took it, and they, you know, dished out their worst desires and terrible things.
Well, you know, Gertrude did. I mean, we can't. I mean, the neighbors. Yes. Horrible people. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. They were completely horrible people. The neighbors could have done something to stop this. They knew what was going on. You can't tell me they didn't. I've seen photos of the house, of the neighborhood. The houses are, you know, you can practically reach out the window and reach the house next door. Mm-hmm. They heard the yelling and the screaming. They heard the things going on. The people who were, you know, in the house next door that heard the screaming that was going on, the beating on the walls when she had the shovel banging on the bricks, they heard it, you know, but you know, when it stopped at 3 a.m., really, how long had it been going on is the question. Yeah. I'd like to know. But they did nothing, you know, they did nothing to help, because it was a mind your own business, you know, and we've talked about this in past seasons about, you know, guys that would, you know, it would beat their wife and nobody do anything about it, because back then times were different. Your wife was practically your property. That's not the case here. These were kids. You know, you had all these kids in this house, and there was no way to miss how many kids were in this house. And yet you hear screaming and crying and begging for help, and you do nothing. You're as evil, or just about as evil, as the woman who's doing the abusing, you know? So the only people here who really messed up, you know, well, okay, besides the neighbors, besides the nurse who came to the house, besides the people at the school who'd gotten the anonymous call, mm-hmm. although that guy could have given his name and he could have followed up on it when nothing was done. So these people suck. But the other people, that the only other adults in this are Lester and Betty. And don't get me wrong, they're not perfect. I mean, these people are not perfect. I mean, they went off and left their kids with a woman they barely knew. I mean, they, you know, when you say family, friend, and I mentioned that, I mean that in the loosest sense. Mm-hmm. You know, Sylvia knew a couple of the daughters. She'd met Gertrude. You know, I think they attended the same church or something that the girls went to. That was it. I mean, she didn't, but the kids also attended that church. So the pastor, who was also part of that church, he never did anything about any of this when Sylvia just suddenly stopped coming to church. You know, he even checked in, and I didn't even get into some of this stuff, and still did nothing about it. But Lester and Betty were just kind of dumb and kind of clueless, you know. Jenny never held it against them for what happened. Their only crime, as far as she was considering it, was that they hadn't really, you know, had naively left them with a woman they thought they could trust. And should they have checked in better? Maybe. But, you know, when they would show up to check on the girls, you know, it was always right there under Gertrude's control. And the girls knew or were terrified. Now, realistically, if they had told their parents, would they have taken them out of the house? Maybe. But they were so scared and so brainwashed themselves by that time and so beaten down that they were afraid to say anything.
Yeah, you want to risk it?
I mean, no. I mean, and it was a big deal when they told their older sister, when they told Diana what was happening. And then she didn't believe them at first. She just thought they were exaggerating. And, you know, I mean, I could also kind of see it from her point of view, is to say, well, you know, these they just don't want to stay there anymore. And I'm sure they'd rather come with me, but we don't have any money and we can't take care of them, you know, because many people would ask, myself included, why they weren't staying with their sister in the first place. Well, they weren't staying with their grandparents either, because everybody had something going on and couldn't do it. Plus, I just don't think most of them could afford it. I mean, you know, poverty sometimes can breed evil.
Yeah.
You know, poverty, you know, everybody talks about poverty breeds crime, and it does. I mean, I think that in a lot of cases, you know, crime-ridden neighborhoods, I mean, we talked about this kind of stuff before. You know, poverty is the leading cause of most crime. And in this case, it's also neglect, you know, or just the fact that there was nothing they can do because they were under the same poverty-stricken conditions that everybody else was. I mean, I don't really think that their parents probably wanted to abandon them to go on the road, but that was the only way they made money, was by running these concessions and carnivals. And, you know, I don't know. You look at it and you think Lester was trying to do the right thing. He didn't want to bring these young girls along on the road, you know, because, you know, it could be pretty skeezy out there in the, you know, the back part of the carnival. Trust me, it can be a little sketchy back there, especially, you know, we're talking about 1960s here. So different times, you know, and he thought he was doing the right thing. And so they're the only adults in this story that get a pass from me. Although I guess Diana did try. She did try, but not hard enough in my opinion. But again, she had no idea if things were as bad as they had been painted by her sisters.
Sure. And I mean, and who's going to who's going to understand or accept that, like, this is the worst case of what could possibly be happening?
Oh my God, no kidding. I mean, yeah, this isn't, you know, she makes us go to bed early or makes us do chores. This is, you know, yeah. I don't even want to get into the I've done enough of the details here. Yeah. I've already been through them. I worked on this and I watched the movie again. I'd seen it once before and really had no desire to ever watch it again. And watched it again, and I literally had nightmares.
Really?
About this story. This really was, I mean, I took longer to write this script than I normally do, just because I didn't want to keep working on it. I kept stopping and putting it off. I mean, this was the equivalent of writing the Marion Parker book for me, which was bad. You know, that is bad. I had somebody, I hosted a pub crawl last weekend, and I had somebody ask me what was the worst story that I'd ever worked on. And, you know, I had named the Marion Parker story and the Grimes sisters. Those were the worst I'd ever worked on. And I said, except for this, you know, this script for this episode, which I never plan to revisit ever again. I'm not going to write about this story ever again. I mean, I usually will post something about it, a shortened version of it, on the anniversary of Sylvia's death, just sort of a, you know, a memoriam to her. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that I ever want to really revisit. I just don't. It's awful. I mean, this is a terrible story. So, yeah, I won't be playing this one back.
Right.
I could tell you.
I agree. I watched the movie, fast forwarded a lot. Just because I was like, okay, yeah, get it.
Did you?
Yeah.
I listen, the episode or the film that I directed everybody toward, An American Crime, is, while horrible, I mean, it's not that it's a horrible film. It's a well acted, well put together, well produced film. So when I say horrible, I mean the content. It's much better than the other one. The other one is, you know, I think I said that. I think I said that in the episode, is that it's much more exploitative. And mm-hmm. and I think a lot of that comes from the book that it's based on. I'm not casting aspersions on Jack Ketchum, but sure, most of his books are pretty exploitative.
Yeah.
And this was, I think, a chance to do a real story. Separate from what he normally does in his horror novels, it was based on a real story that I think he probably felt really bad about. But on the other hand, that's how he writes. And the film really reflects that. And it's just, I mean, if anybody wants to see it, it's actually easier to find than this one is. I don't understand why. I mean, this was a film that, you know, premiered at Sundance and things. And believe me, the other one, The Girl Next Door, did not.
Uh-huh.
This one did. This one is well filmed. It's well written. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to defend the story in any way. I'm just saying, if you've got to watch the film, this is the one that you'd want to watch, unless you're just really looking for, you know, wanting to abuse yourself and watch the other one. You know, that's all I can say.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that, you know, every now and then when we do a story like this, it's, you know, we want to remember the victims. We want to show that, you know, how horrible people can be and not let them off.
Yeah. You know, they certainly made it clear that people are horrible in this one.
Yes.
And again, I still can't get past, I mean, as monstrous as this Gertrude is, I still can't get past the kids. That's the thing that bugs me more than anything about this, is the way they took part in it. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could say, like, say her kids, her own kids, although I'm pretty sure John was just a psychopath.
Sure.
But I think even her kids might. Well, OK, I take that back. Paula definitely was a psychopath, too. But like Stephanie, you know, I think that the other kids might have did it because they had to.
Right.
You know, I mean, or at least were talked into the fact that mentally it was OK to do it,
mm-hmm.
even though it certainly wasn't. Which is
wild. Yeah,
I know. But, you know, Gertrude tried to justify all this by telling these kids, oh, you know, she said terrible things about you, or she's promiscuous, she's a whore, you know, she deserves to be punished. And I think that was a big part of it. I think that, you know, I think Paula and John, especially Paula, I guess, really, was just as depraved as their mother was.
Right.
You know, the other kids at least had a chance.
That's the thing. You know? Yeah. Could they have had a chance if not for this?
But I guess then my point was that while her kids may have been pushed into it, there's no excuse for the neighborhood.
Right.
Kids.
Right.
Who just got to come over and pay a nickel or whatever it was just so they could watch her be abused or, you know, take part in it. You know, I don't even know where to go with that.
Right.
It's just horrific.
You know? It is. Yeah.
Just horrific.
It's just so bizarre, the things people can, I don't want to say be lured into or anything, but the parts of yourself you can, I guess, realize or actualize.
Yeah. And the worst of the kids ended up in juvenile detention, mm-hmm. and then got out in 2 years when they turned 18. And then, you know, the five other kids that were charged with, you know, injury to person, who really got off with a slap on the wrist. But I think the most depraved, or at least the most upsetting part of it, is the kids that they didn't charge. They couldn't charge because even though they had taken part in it, they were too young to be charged. Now, how do you think those kids turned out?
I hated when you said that. I was like,
I mean, I was able to find information about the three that went to reform school, all of whom, none of whom really turned out great. But I don't know what happened to the rest of them. But I'm going to say this is something that I don't know how you'd ever forget it. I don't know how we would ever get out of your head. Mm-hmm. I just don't.
Mm-hmm. And it brings up, sick. It brings up a lot of nature versus nurture stuff too.
Yeah. Like, yeah, for sure.
Gosh. Yeah.
Well, this is one that, you know, I did as I was halfway through the script, I thought, why did we include this
one? Yeah, you did this.
I really did. I know I did. And I did have some regrets about including it. But on the other hand, I thought, well, you know, maybe it doesn't hurt us to see just how messed up people are to know that, you know, we can do better. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I don't know what to say to
and,
that.
And if nothing else too, it's like, you know, I'm when it's with kids and stuff, I'm going to err on the side of maybe I'm being an asshole, but hey, if I think that kid's in danger, I'm going to find out and push.
Well, see, that's the thing. Well, times have changed, and it's stories like this one that are the reason that times have changed.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's because of stuff like this. And maybe that in itself is reason enough to include the film and to include the story.
So, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, you know, I know that there are like, I've seen pranks and different things or whatever, but it's like, if a kid's yelling, "You're not my dad," I'm going to be like, okay, hold on.
We're
going to get to the fucking bottom.
I did see a really funny tweet about that. That it just went through. I popped up in my, you know, doom scrolling the other day, and it popped up and it said, there was a guy, I observed this man was carrying a screaming kid underneath his arm as he was leaving a place. And, the guy looked me right in the eye and said, "Don't worry, it's my kid. Because if it wasn't, why would I kidnap this little asshole?"
Yes.
So
I did see you post that, and I
thought, okay, that's funny.
Yeah, exactly. When you're carrying a kid by the leg at a Target,
kind of get that one. So, good riddance to Gertrude. Good riddance to all of these people. Good riddance to this episode and to this story. I don't ever need to think about it or talk about it again. Frankly.
Yes.
So, to be that way, but no thanks.
Did you say the next one's also bad?
This was the one that was bad. Last time was bad, but I think I told you the next one will be much worse. Actually, we're going to get into some stuff that we'll have some room to, you know, make a little fun of.
Okay. All right.
Coming up. So yeah, God. It's going to get better after this, I swear.
All right. Well, hey, on that note, you want to take us out then? Like, cause we
no, I'm going to talk behind. About, I'm going to talk about the Ghostwriter segment.
Oh yes.
You may or may not have any,
I don't.
Emails from, but if you, anybody who's listening wants to come up with one, you can email Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Or you can text us on the hotline as some of you had, which is 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show. Now, before we get to the text that I have, I've got four stories that I would love to see turn into film. And as they're all going to be very predictable, as far as for anybody who listens to the show or who knows me or definitely to you. But stories I'd like to see turned into film would be H.H. Holmes, for starters, which we've heard on and on and on about that for years now, that Leonardo DiCaprio had the movie rights and it was going to be a Scorsese film. And then at one point it was going to have Keanu Reeves in it as the architect, as the devil in the White City. They were going to go back and forth. He was going to play Daniel Burnham. Just as long as he's not playing H.H. Holmes, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. I could see DiCaprio as H.H. Holmes. I think he'd be good. But anyway, I also mentioned last time I'd love to see a good Capone movie. You know, other than The Untouchables, which is not a Capone movie, but I'd love to see one. I'd also like to see a Belle Gunness story, which was that, you know, the Indiana woman who murdered a serial killer who murdered an unknown number of people. We had done a Patreon season on that, on Belle Gunness, but I think it'd make a good film. I would love to see an actual Black Dahlia movie, you know, of that story. I mean, there is a movie called The Black Dahlia, Brian De Palma film. It's interesting for what it is, but it's really not about the Black Dahlia. It sort of surrounds the case. It's really about two cops, Aaron Eckhart and Josh Hartnett. It's a decent film. I mean, the explanation and the solving of the mystery is ridiculous. It's terrible, but it's still, it's not a terrible film, but it could have been great, you know, because it came out around the same time as L.A. Confidential, a short time later, which is one of the best films about L.A. noir ever. And I thought this was going to be the next one. And instead, I was just underwhelmed. And it's too bad because it could have been a great movie. But I'd love to see that. And I would love to see Grimes Sisters movie, the other story that I mentioned that I find pretty disturbing about the two sisters that disappeared around Christmas time and bodies didn't turn up for a couple of weeks after. And, you know, we talked about this before. But anyway, those are some of the ones that I would love to see get turned into a movie. Did you have a chance to work on a list?
No, I completely forgot about it. But
I wondered about that. I should have reminded you. I really should have.
But I have some immediate thoughts, though. And you might even be able to tell me, like, well, Cody, there is a movie about this or that or the other thing. I'm looking, is there a good D.B. Cooper movie?
No, not really. Not that I'm aware of. I do remember it being a kind of a side story, a B story when that show Prison Break was on.
Yeah.
Remember one of the prisoners at Fox River was D.B. Cooper and told them how to find the money. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah.
That was kind of fun. I think that would make it'd make a good film. I mean, everybody talks about it. You know, I don't think there has been. I could be wrong. If anyone knows of one or I'm forgetting about something, let me know. And we'll just send it, text it to us on the hotline. And I'll definitely look it up and I'll mention that. But I can't think of one off the top of my head. Did you find something?
1981 adventure movie titled The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper.
Really? Was it a documentary or a film?
Well, it says Robert Duvall is an insurance investigator pursuing him based on a novel, Free Fall.
Huh. Well, that's news to me. Well, I'll have to see if I can find it. What's it called? The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper.
Yep.
I like Robert Duvall. I'll have to see if I can find it. That sounds, it's hard to say, but it might be good.
Treat Williams as Cooper.
Oh, okay. Well, I like him too.
Yeah,
okay. Check it out. So I remember I kept thinking of Melvin and Howard and I'm like, oh no, that's Howard Hughes. That's a pretty good movie, but and from about the same time period. I don't know why I didn't remember that one, but I'll check it out.
You know what else?
But we could use a new one. That was a long time ago.
Yeah,
I think 40 years ago, man. So gosh. Yeah.
Something else I do like those. I want more. I don't know if I want more. I want more well told, but rewrites of history like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood stuff.
Oh, so do I. Yeah, okay, that's one of my favorite movies of all time, really. And you know, I was just thinking too that I just listed off four different things that I thought would make a great film, but you know what they'd make better? They'd make great limited series instead, you know, 10 episodes, 8 episodes even, because I don't think that a lot of things, and that may be why so many things like this that are good stories have not been told, because they require more space than a film can give them. You know, it's just like when they said they were going to make a film of, you know, a couple of years after the last attempt to do The Stand by Stephen King, they were going to make a film of it. You can't make a film of that. It's massive. You could choke a horse with that book. It's so big. It's so much story. And all of the things I listed are pretty much the same thing. You know, they're stories that would be better told in a different kind of format. I think that things are changing. And I think that we're starting to see more of that, honestly. And I hope that we'll get some more. And my only issue is that every time they do one of these and they think it needs a second season, it doesn't. It just tell the story and be done. So we're starting to see a little more of that. When they did The Alienist a few years ago, that's one of my favorites. They took both books and they told each one in a season. There were two books, two seasons. That was it. They didn't come back and try to do another one, you know, that they made up on the fly. And that's what irritates me. I wish they wouldn't do that. But anyway, we better get to some of these texts. So our first one comes to us from Bryce from Tucson. He's a regular flyer, frequent flyer. He said that you had a hotliner, which I kind of like that name, that term for people who send in texts, a hotliner, mentioned their admiration for O.J. Simpson growing up. Fun fact about him, he was considered to play the Terminator back in 1984, but producers shot the idea down because they felt O.J. was too nice of a guy and no one would believe he was a killer cyborg. Wow. What a difference 10 years can make. So that's pretty funny. And to be fair, he still had that reputation then, despite the reality. In L.A., where I grew up, he was treated like a god by everyone, cops included. You're absolutely right on that. So, all right. So this one comes to us from Amanda in the 931. This is Amanda from Nashville. I wanted to add to my story about the Wellwitch Cave. She had mentioned she had sent us a message before, and she said, I can confirm the stories about relationship issues after stealing rocks. After the four of us had car wrecks, the four of us who had been lifelong friends since elementary school for no reason whatsoever split up as friends. We just stopped talking. We had our picture taken on a rock outside the cave, and it was almost as if an invisible line was cut between us. Two of us split off from the other two. We didn't reconnect for 5 years, and to this day, we don't even know why we stopped talking to each other. That was almost 20 years ago. I have so many stories from the visits to the cave. I could go on forever.
Wow. So,
this one comes to us from Kelsey in the 618. She said, catching up on the Albert Fish season, and I had coffee come out my nose on the needles in your taint comment. You'd have to listen to understand what I mean by that. But she said, what a way to wake up on Monday morning. Love you guys. Keep up the great work. P.S. I keep trying to write into the Ghostwriter section, and I don't know if it's going through. So let me know. You got any messages from Kelsey on an email?
I will have to check.
Yeah, Cody says he will check on that. And if you're for some reason you got the email address wrong, it's AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll take a look. So, all right, this one comes to us from Michelle in the 913, and it says, hey, Troy, you were right. I usually enjoy novels and novelizations of movies more than the movies because of the deeper story, but I just finished reading Jaws and much prefer the movie. The book was not great. Should have listened to you, Michelle. Sometimes my advice is good. Not always, but in that one, it is.
50-50.
This one comes to us from Aaron, and let me see where he is coming from. He's coming from the 217, so that's an easy one. He said, I just listened to the Entity episode, and you were answering a question about a story you'd like made into a movie, as we just did. My question is, are there any Houdini movies, shows, miniseries out there that are good and pretty accurate? And the answer to that would be absolutely no. Okay. There are not. Unfortunately, there aren't. There was one done a few years ago with what's that dude's name? I like him. Big Nose.
Me?
No. He was in he was in The Village. He played the guy, the mentally challenged guy who
Adrian stabs. Something.
Is it Adrian Brody?
And I think that's him, right?
Maybe. Yeah. It's not terrible. I mean, it's not great, but it's not terrible. The Tony Curtis one, that's the old one. That's the original Houdini movie. He dies in a water tank at the end, so that's not accurate. There was a movie that came out that's impossible to find now, to the point that without me going on to IMDb right now, I could not begin to tell you what the name of it was. But Guy Pearce played Houdini, and Catherine Zeta-Jones played a medium that he was investigating that he ends up having an affair with, which, again, super not accurate at all. Don't remember the name of it. I'm not even sure what kind of release it got. I was given a screener of it by my buddy who was in the movie business at the time, or in the video business. So that's how long ago it was.
Death-defying acts.
Okay. Death-defying. Okay. That does ring a bell now that you say that. So I've never seen it again. I've never seen it listed anywhere. I don't know where you would find it. Maybe I'll do a search on it just out of curiosity. I don't know. I have no idea. But no, not really. I've never really seen anything that is accurate, unfortunately. It would be nice if it was, if there, something would come out. So there's another one that I think would make a really good limited series.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a start and it's got a finish, and you don't have to, you don't really have to do much to make him seem exciting, because the dude was definitely exciting in his lifetime. So, all right. So this one comes to us from the 985. This is our last one. It says, but by the way, I live in the 678 now. Not long ago, I had the opportunity to recommend The Devil Came to St. Louis. I especially love the last two sections. Thank you for your exacting research and compelling writing. And thanks, Cody, for your technical ability and capacity to keep Troy on track.
Hey,
I don't know if you unfortunately,
just let me have this.
It's a constant battle. No, I'm not saying you're not good at it. I'm just saying you're constantly battling. They added love the show. So, wait, I saw one from Rick Ray. It's just from Rick, our friend Rick. He's over in the St. Louis area. He says, I was watching YouTube videos about St. Louis, and to my surprise, one of my favorite podcast hosts and authors pops up in top 10 creepiest stories from St. Louis in a YouTube show. It was something I had done for like PBS a few years ago.
Okay.
He did say that he was excited to see it. So that was nice. Thanks, Rick. So
that's awesome.
But yeah, always good to hear from him and our other frequent flyers, as well as our new people who pop up every now and again with something else they have questions about. So if you are one of those people that'd like to ask us something, try the hotline, 217-791-7859, and it might get read on the show. So, all right, now I'll wrap it up. How's
yes,
that sound?
Yes.
All right. Thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show, and if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or even people you meet on the street. Encourage everyone you know to listen, and if you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, or go to Spotify or wherever. But don't forget that as an American Hauntings listener, you can use the discount code podcast for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because just remember, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful. This episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor. For some reason, he wrote this episode.
I know.
And then I have to produce it right after this.
I will regret it.
Yes, by me, Cody Beck. So to find out more about the show, check out our show notes or go to the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com.
You're overhauling, correct?
I am overhauling. Yes. Oh, awesome. Yeah, it's cool. Got a little stale.
Everything needs an update every once in a while.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. So if you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the hotline, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, probably some other social media spots I don't remember. We're not doing any other social. No.
No, I think that's pretty it. Much that's it. Pretty I don't much think it. There's. I mean, I think that if I post something on Instagram, I think it goes on Threads, but I don't have any probably. Idea because I never look at it.
Who wants
but
to?
But I think it just automatically goes there.
Yeah.
Which I never understood it anyway, so I'm certainly not going to try now. I guess we could probably just leave that off here.
Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
All right.
All right, cool. Yeah, that worked out all right.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.